boogie jabbing rap is life. Where I'm from, where I'm from. A mod play with Izzy, where I'm from, where I'm from. It be like run your coat black. Jupiter keeps a fat beat by the pack. Where I'm from, nappy hair is life. We be reading marks where I'm from. The kids be rocking clocks where I'm from. You turn around your cap, you talk over a beat. And Dixon sounds booming out of Jeep where I'm from.
Gav, this series was called, slash is called, The Rise of Kenny. I suppose this part of his rise would be known as the plateau of Kenny. What has 2020 been like?
Bumpy as hell for him, hasn't it? Jeez. I know it's his dream job, but you can't imagine it turning out like this, you know? No wins, one goal, empty stadia, loads of injuries and COVID cases, all manner of shenanigans going on in the background and off the field. He's done pretty well to keep a brave face and things.
Yeah, so if we look at it with all of the world and its problems in the mix, maybe it's been a good year for Stephen Kenny.
I know, I don't think you can say it's a good year. I think it's been, like, it hasn't been great, you know. But I think I wouldn't be very critical of him, and I wouldn't be drawing any conclusions from the first, what, 8 games in charge based off what we've seen so far, because there are so many mitigating circumstances. You know, he's had hardly any time to work with the players, you know, because we're now in an age of 3 games per window, which means you end up getting, you know, a day and a half training before a game, and then you're straight into it, and ideally then develop a rhythm on the pitch. But he's been denied that fact by injuries and COVID cases. I mean, by the time we got round to the last game at home to Bulgaria, he lost more than half of the squad he named for the entire window through cases and to injury. I think the fewest game-to-game changes he's made has been 3. Twice he's had to make 6. So he's had no chance to develop a rhythm and develop, you know, because that's the point of his being appointed, you know, the fact that there will be more holistic style, and we will be attacking more, and more will be asked and expected of the players, because, you know, the manager fundamentally believes that they're capable of meeting that challenge. He just hasn't got a chance to do it, you know. So it's been mocked by circumstance. We'll get into as to whether, you know, like, I mean, Jesus, no wins and one goal is bad. Like, do the circumstances totally mitigate against that? I don't think so. I think I still think we could have done better than we have done, despite all that's happened. But it really has been tough for him, I have to say.
The fact I was saying it was a good year was the fact that he got from the start of the year to the end of the year. Given everything that happened,
without being
he's
sacked,
still the Ireland
it?
Manager. Yeah, he's still the Ireland manager. The public hasn't risen up in full against him, and it seems as if the journalists are still on board. And as much as we like to say, who cares if the journalists are on board, I think that is a big factor. So it's a good year in terms of, like, people seem to have given him a little bit of a free pass this year, and it'll be next year where he starts to get judged.
I don't think that should be the bar for a good year, because I'm still quivering with post-traumatic stress disorder, having read this year's FAI accounts that were curiously published 3 minutes after the World Cup qualifier draw, by the way. But the FAI said they were legally obliged to put it out at that point. They're €70 million in debt. They cannot afford to sack Stephen Kenny anytime soon. And they also can't afford to hire anyone. Like, if you're going to start sacking him, who out there is any better? You know, and who won't cost £1 million a year? Like,
would Mick McCarthy come back?
I mean, that man has enriched himself so much off the FAI. But also, you know, has added, been a great servant for Irish football, etc., etc. I mean, I think the fate, maybe we are fated to a third reign of Mick down the line, but certainly something I don't want to hang around for. So I don't think, I mean, there's no chance of him getting sacked anytime soon. Like, I mean, I think his wage is like a third of what Mick was on. And, you know, he's had to take a pay deferral like everyone else in the FAI because of COVID.
September the 3rd, 2020, Bulgaria won, Ireland won. It was like our first international game, I'd say about 9 months, 10 months maybe. Mick McCarthy was on commentary duty for Sky Sports. Shane Duffy, who at that stage was playing well with Celtic and scoring goals nearly every weekend in Celtic's charge for 10, which then hadn't blown up yet. Shane Duffy scored, was captain that night. He was very proud, and he scored a last-minute equaliser. What was Stephen Kenny taking from that game afterwards?
There was some positives in that game, you know? Like the easy joke was, oh, look at our revolution. We draw games 1-1, and Shane Duffy scores from a corner. But in fairness, if you watch the game, there were kind of more, it's more progress made to what Stephen Kenny had talked about than I think we kind of expected, or certainly I expected anyway. Like, Kenny was talking boldly ahead of that game. You know, he's talking about my ambition here in, as Irish manager is to, you know, break our association with the British style, you know, and to give Irish football a definable style that essentially that opposition managers in Europe won't be saying, you know, they're tough, they're physical, tough to break down with great supporters, that our stereotype would ultimately change. But we made something like 700 or 800 passes in that game. Like, we outpassed Bulgaria to a considerable degree. The players definitely did get the ball down and play in the manner that Kenny would have preached about ahead of the game. The other things to take away from it, I think we learned of his pragmatism soon after that game. We played a 4-3-3 with James McCarthy as the pivot at the back of that midfield. That was changed. By the time we got to Slovakia a month later in the playoffs, he kind of, what a Brendan Rodgers phrase is, to flip the midfield triangle. So he basically played 4-2-3-1 rather than 4-3-3 because we needed that. Like, we were too open in the second half. You remember that Bulgaria goal was way too easy to pass through us.
Oh yeah, like the Irish defence for that Bulgaria goal are so wide as well. No one's on top of Karev, and to be fair to Mick McCarthy, points it out on CoComs. But anyone could have pointed it out on CoComs. That was the big thing to come from that night. The fact that when everyone tuned in to watch it, they heard this accent, and straight away everyone was like, "That's Mick McCarthy. What is he doing?" How strange was that?
I thought it was really bad. Plus, like, what a cosmic aberration! Like, how many things have to go wrong for Mick McCarthy's voice to be in everyone's head that night? Because all of the journalists writing about it, bar I think the Sunday Times, Paul Rowan is the only Irish journal to actually go to that game. We were all watching it from TV, so we're all watching it with Mick telling us what was happening, you know, like this goat, like, you know, Banquo's ghost haunting Kenny and us all from the long and distant past. Even I don't think it did make McCarthy's reputation among Irish fans a whole lot of good. I know it's part of the gig now, you know, if you're an out of work manager, you go on TV to put yourself in the shop window, as it were. But I didn't think it was great. And, you know, all he talked about was, you know, putting the ball in the box and crossing. And that fucking Gibraltar game away last year. I remember we were at that game and McCarthy came in after and said it was a horrible game, never want to hear anything more about it again. And no one has done more to keep Gibraltar 0, Ireland 1 in the public consciousness than Mick McCarthy, who's still talking about the pitch and the wind and Darren Randall's save. Oh, like, I mean, it was almost like, you know, Kenny was like, this new era, we're moving on. And it was almost like a not too subtle reminder of how difficult it is to move on, because with Mick McCarthy doing commentary. And you even saw during that game the first signs of discontent already, like Ian Hart tweeting, I'm all for giving young lads their debuts, but this is, come on, like, football is about winning matches and so on. And you've seen
at which point everyone then made reference to the fact that Mick McCarthy, you know, didn't get a win in his first 6 or 7 games as well.
Totally. Yeah, totally. And I remember Jason McAteer was initially critical, was wondering about, you know, will the players respect this guy? You know, his CV, he's never done it in England. But in fairness, like, I mean, Stephen Kenny has coached in Europe more than any of his players had played in Europe, you know, and I think we saw even in that first window that notion of the players wouldn't respect his CV and wouldn't listen to his message. I think the way they played that game and how they passed the ball, I think that showed that to be nonsense, you know. I think they really do buy into what Stephen is telling them, and they do seem to quite like him. We'll get on to the turmoil after November later on in the show, but I don't think that criticism stood up to any kind of rigor or interrogation a few days into that first window.
Before his first match, he, I suppose, had the first bit of controversy of his reign, and that was Michael Obafemi tweeting interesting, and then later on deleting the tweet. How has Michael Obafemi stood up in terms of, should he have been included in games under Kenny? I suppose if you're in the pub and you're talking about players to look forward to the future, Obafemi is a name that comes up. And I also did think it was interesting that he didn't get called up in that first game. But I suppose as the season progressed, it shows that Kenny was within his rights not to do that.
Yeah, that very first squad was the one which he thought maybe Obafemi might get called up because there was this erroneous belief among people that Kenny will get the job and then he'll play all of his under-21s. as it's turned out, he has promoted a lot of them, but that was more through circumstance than by design. He's always likely to play quite an experienced team. Like, he told a few of us in January, he knew what his back five was going to be, and it was going to be Randolph, Doherty, Egan, Duffy, and Stevens. Like, they're all guys in their mid-20s. I think John Egan might be the youngest there, and he's, 25 or 26. So he's never really going to throw all these youngsters in. I remember the Obafemi thing. We were at a press conference with Kenny out in, where was it? In Umbro headquarters in some industrial park in somewhere on the edge of Dublin. And Obafemi tweeted that.
Umbro, which is now quite cool, from that New Yorker front cover a few weeks back.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, the New Yorker had a front cover, their famous front covers, yeah. And it was like a millennial in her apartment, and her apartment was a bit of a mess, but she was Zoom calling someone, and she had like a glass of champagne and her hair done up, and she was wearing a pair of Umbro shorts. Umbro is now high fashion.
Well, we were out with a home of high fashion then, out with Umbro, and it was just before we went in, about 5 minutes, I got a message to say, look at this, and it was Michael Obafemi tweeting. So I think Kenny might have had a word with his press officer just before we came in, but he dealt with it perfectly fine. It was just like, Michael will be a great player for Ireland. And he was very upfront and honest about why he wasn't included. He says that, we're going to play 4-3-3. He's used to playing in a front two at Southampton, so he needs to develop tactically and learn the ways of that formation. And they said, go to the under-21s and he'll learn it there, which is actually quite a good thing when you think about it, the fact that we can actually use the under-21s as a kind of preparation school for the seniors, because the one of the main problems, one of the first thing that Kenny has addressed, has been the distance between that under-21 team and the senior team. A lot of the time, in a recurring criticism of that team is that we're just capping lads from England in the hope that they'll stick around for senior team. And there was too much of it. It took too long for under-21s to get recognised in the senior team, like Matt Doherty and John Egan. Kenny says this at every window when he gets the chance. It took them like 3 and 5 years or something, I think, respectively, to leave the 21s and get their first cap at senior level. So I also thought that was a good thing, that Kenny was coming from the 21s and there would be that link between the two teams. But as we've shown, like, Obafemi's done nothing all year. He's not in the Southampton team at all. He's, Shea Adams has come in now. He's behind him, Danny Ings, Shane Long, in the reckoning. He's hardly played at all. So that was a minor little skirmish. I know, like, every Irish manager must deal with questions about the prodigal son who's been ostracised. We've had it with Andy Reid and Stephen Ireland and Wes Hoolahan. So now maybe it's Michael Obafemi, but Kenny dealt with it perfectly well in the first instance, and I don't think there's any issues there between the two of them. And anyway, I mean, Obafemi, I don't think anyone would argue he deserves a call-up. He has since deserved a senior call-up.
Yeah, Liam Brady was actually a prodigal son as well, back in Italia 90, when he had basically retired from football, and Dunphy, who had spent the 80s criticising Brady, then made Brady the Wes Hoolahan of 89-90. So, the prodigal son has been around now for a while in Irish football. But just when you're talking about the under-21s there, is maybe that's something we should give the Kenny revolution, or whatever you want to call it, is that its first success. If you think about the under-21s before Stephen Kenny became manager of the under-21s, they were playing in front of crowds of nobody. Kenny came in, they kind of actually became cool. It became, I remember on international weeks, I was nearly more looking towards the under-21 result than I was at the senior result when Stephen Kenny was manager. Let's put that down as his first success to rejuvenate and make the under-21s an actual thing.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Look, I believed at the time, and I still believe, that the succession planning of appointing McCarthy for a year and then giving it to Kenny, I thought it was total horse shit. Like, it was real, like, typical harebrained John Delaney compromise. But at the same time, I remember being in Gibraltar. We won in Gibraltar, and came home and just got off the flight and opened my phone, and the 21s were playing, who was the first game against at home in Tala? Was it Luxembourg maybe? I can't remember, but they'd won 3-1, like a nearly packed house at Tala, and Jason Malumbi had been brilliant for 80 minutes and came off, and Kenny grabbed him and turned around to the crowd and said, did you see this man's performance? He was absolutely brilliant. And that 21s team had Connolly, Ida, Parrott, Malumbi, and I was like, I'm beginning to be convinced of the genius of this. Perhaps John Delaney has left us with an act of genius. But he got the nation interest in the under 21 team. Absolutely. Now, that's partly down to him, and that's partly down to the talent that he had. You know, we had, like, for the first time, like, Ida Connolly, Parrott especially, like, these guys were on the fringes of their first team in the senior team, so that helped as well.
Sunday, 6th of September, Republic of Ireland 0, Finland 1. I had a look back at this game as well. Again, it's only the second game in, but it's starting to set the tempo of how Kenny Games would go for the rest of 2020. Lots of chances, lots of possession, but no goals scored.
Yeah, when you said you look back, did you watch all these games back?
I watched the Sky Sports snippets. Oh, God. I did not go and watch these back in full.
It's like, well, God, once we get into late October, November, I was going to start feeling sorry for you. Yeah, this was decent. I wasn't massively impressed by this performance. I remember this was the only game in which he didn't really have any COVID issues beforehand, you know? So he only had to... He changed three players. He just changed the whole midfield. And the thrust of it was we want to get a look at everyone ahead of the Slovakia game. He was, in fairness, using these games as preparation for the Euro 2020 playoff the following month against Slovakia. I remember Jason Malumbi made his debut in here and was quite good. Kenny has a nice quote about Malumbi that has this chaotic energy. I'm bang into that. Just brings that level of chaos. And he talked about how Malumbi developed at Brighton and particularly at Millwall, and he became a little bit more polished in terms of passing and so on. But Kenny doesn't want him to lose that all action, chaotic energy, as you say. Malumbi's not as good a player, but he reminds me a little bit of a young Steven Gerrard, just in terms of that all action, dynamic midfielder who throws himself into tackles and might get sent off a little bit too often. But remember, Malumbi played well. We also conceded. This became a recurring theme throughout that Nations League. Like, we'd be better and it'd be 0-0, and then we'd concede usually around the 65th minute mark. I think three times we lost 1-0 in this Nations League group because of conceding goals around that moment. Again, we were too easy to play through in midfield. Again, there was a mega gap between Matt Doherty at right back and Shane Duffy at centre back. Obviously my distinct memory of this game is an empty Aviva Stadium. Like, it was so eerie and so weird. And one of the things, I think one of the...
There's a good photograph of Stephen Kenny before the match, kind of in centre circle, and he's looking around. He's obviously taking a moment to himself to be like, oh, like, I'm here, but there's nobody there.
I know, and I really do feel sorry for him and old players playing in empty grounds. And I think one of the misconceptions about Kenny is that, you know, he's just like this tactical super brain who just goes to work and is, you know, totally ignorant of the circumstances around him. He's a very emotional guy, and I think he's very good at motivating his players and engaging them into why it's important to play this game and why it's important to play for the play in the shirt you're wearing and for your family and so on. And it's very hard to do that in an empty stadium. You know, I really actually think that, you know, I've often said of previous managers like O'Neill and Mick McCarthy that they're great motivators, you know, that they'll be able to motivate a good group of lads. Kenny has that in spades. You know, I think that's one of his best qualities. He just talks about the game in a different way that the media don't attribute that as his main strength or characteristic, whereas we do with McCarthy and O'Neill, who, you know, treated media with contempt at times, to be honest. But I think that having to play in an empty ground really, really takes something from Kenny himself, I think, and the team as well.
Yeah, even referencing back to what you said about the under-21s and how Kenny turned to the crowd and engaged the crowd with the player. And, you know, if you think back to his Dundalk days and how he'd, you know, fist pump the shed and stuff like that, he definitely isn't oblivious to a crowd when there's a crowd at the match.
No, absolutely not. And look, populist is a bad word to use because it's so loaded, etc. But he knows how to play to a crowd as well. Like, the reason he got, turn our minds back to 2018, the reason he got the Ireland job, because the reason John Delaney had to do the succession plan and give in to the public clamour for Kenny was because he was, you know, good at getting a crowd on his side. You know, he was kind of, he went about pitching himself for the job in such a separate and different way. So Mick McCarthy did the classic thing of turning up on Irish TV to do punditry 6 months ahead of time. And, you know, wouldn't be drawn on camera, but made, you know, by what he left out in his punditry, made it clear that I'm here, I'm available, I want the job. And, you know, McCarthy would have, you know, would have an agent who would talk to journalists. He would have an extensive network of former players who'd put in a good word for him when their opinion was asked. And Kenny just rang Emmett Malone of the Irish Times and said, I have none of that, but I want this job, and this job is the pinnacle for me. So, and I think that seeing Kenny as separate to a kind of Irish football establishment, or like all the figures that had gone before, and indeed the FAI itself, I think that's very important. And I think that will continue to be an important narrative or part of Stephen Kenny as Ireland manager, because, and I'm going to talk about this again in the context of the Videogate stuff we'll get onto later on, but seeing Kenny as separate to that, I think is quite important in understanding how he got the job, why he got the job. And I think it will be an important part of his job going forward.
Yeah, I suppose even to ring up Emmett and then to pitch himself publicly in the newspaper, like, kind of shows that there is different sides to Kenny. Sometimes people think Kenny is quite reserved and maybe not up for, you know, public battles and stuff like that. But to go and launch himself at the job the way he did at that time shows that there is, like, I can do this, why not me, approach about the man as well.
Oh, totally. And, like, it's been clear from the previous episodes of your series, Kev, like, this is a man of massive conviction and self-belief.
The biggest game of the year was our third attempt at qualifying for the Euros, which I suppose will go ahead in 2021. Slovakia against Ireland. Like, yeah, I watched back the RT post-match there earlier on, and I think Dara, actually, I just have the quote written down here. It's like, it hasn't, but basically, to paraphrase, is like, it hasn't been the same since Robbie Keane left. You know, Robbie Keane stopped playing for Ireland a long time ago. And post-match, after our biggest game in 12 months, we're talking about Robbie Keane. But yeah, Robbie Keane hasn't been replaced. Again, we didn't score goals. Matt Doherty had a chance. Matt Doherty, maybe actually before we launch into this, we can talk about, like, how have you felt Matt Doherty's year has gone since the transfer? He's now obviously on the bench at Tottenham, apart from Europa League games. But just watching him back in these Ireland games as well, maybe you're kind of expecting a little bit more, a little bit something else, and it kind of really hasn't happened.
Yeah. Well, first of all, in the Wales game at home, he had to switch to centre back, and I thought he was absolutely brilliant, in fairness to him. No, it's not really worked out. How's it worked out for Doherty? No, we haven't seen him, but he's been playing a different role than, so
maybe we're looking at him a little bit differently now because of the transfer.
Yeah, but the Doherty that we kind of expect to see in an Ireland shirt is the one that played for Wolves as a right wing back, you know. So that's like, that is a role that allows him to arrive late into the box and get his head on things. And he's done that once or twice. He did that against, was it Bulgaria away? Or maybe was it this game? He arrived late at the back post and headed just over. So we've seen him get into the box a little bit, and definitely Finland away, he had a couple of chances. I wouldn't be too down on Doherty. He's looked, I think he was exposed a little bit too much at right back in the opening couple of games, particularly on that Finland game at home. But he's talked about needing to learn a different position to play in a flat back four rather than as a wing back. And in that context, I thought, wow, the move to Tottenham is absolutely perfect for him. But now, unfortunately, he's lost his place in the team. You know, we're recording this the morning after Liverpool-Tottenham, and Serge Aurier was at right back instead of him up against Sadio Mane and was absolutely brilliant. Ironically, the right back I've seen play best against Mane before that was Seamus Coleman back after the lockdown at the Goodison Derby in May or in June or whenever that was. So Doherty, he's got his chance. He's not been fantastic, but I wouldn't be too concerned about him either. I think, in fairness, he's been moved around a bit in the team. Like, he's played at left back as well as centre back. He hasn't got a run of games at right back either, and he's effectively learning a new position. And the worry for Ireland really is that if he stays out of the Tottenham team, like, I mean, international football being the way it is, we need him to adapt to right back and learn that position at club level. So hopefully he will get back in the Spurs team and continue to do that.
Yeah, so back to Slovakia, I did watch this more in full than just the highlights, and the one man who stands out above all the others, who didn't at the time when I was watching it, but I think I was just too nervous watching the match on the night to actually realise what was happening, is McGoldrick. Mm. McGoldrick's superb in this game, but he drops so deep. Everything good about Ireland seems to go through him. He just has a really good game. He doesn't play for Ireland anymore.
It's a killer, isn't it? Like, that's possibly McGoldrick's best game for Ireland, and it looks like his last as well. Yeah, I think he's only made 14 caps, you know, like, that's more of a, he got lost in the wilderness. I know There was always murmurings that he'd fell out with Martin O'Neill, but in fairness, McGoldrick, whenever we asked him about it, he never stood them up. He's like, no, there's nothing there. I was injured. I was out of form for Ipswich in the Championship. I wasn't playing well enough to get into the team, which is, I suppose, fair enough. But there is a feeling like, God, that's another international career that we didn't get enough out of, you know, like Wes Hoolahan. You know, there's been too many of them.
I thought the Twitter reaction to McGoldrick's retirement was a bit off. Like, it was, I saw a lot of, like, you know, mean tweets of people being like, oh no, we're going to miss you.
Oh, because
like,
you only
are going to miss him.
Because you only scored one goal. But the people who are saying that don't watch the games. You know, they just look at stats. You know, he was terrific. I think he won the Player of the Year for 2019. He was the best player in Mick McCarthy's team, and he was the best player in the biggest game of 2020 as well. He just makes everyone around him play better. You know, his touch is exceptional. Like, he drops deep. And one of the big things that Ireland really missed after he left in those latter few games was he just didn't have an outlet to hold the ball up front. You know, Adam Ida is still learning the game. I think he'll be a good player, but his hold-up play is not as good as McGoldrick's. McGoldrick dropped deep, and his movement is very clever. And he brought the best period of Irish play in that game against Slovakia was when Alan Brown came on, and the two linked up really well, because Brown is one of the few players in the Irish team that will, you know, a few midfielders will bomb on and gamble beyond the striker, and those two linking up in tandem looked very promising for Ireland. I know Brown forced the save of the near post from the Slovakian keeper not long after coming on, and then both were involved in that move that Howrahan somehow missed. You know, Jesus Christ, like, I mean, I think he probably, that chance is still flashing before his eyes when he looks back in 2020. So I think that's the most frustrating thing at all. Like, in my excitement after that game, I know we lost on penalties. I remember tweeting that was Ireland's best performance since Paris in 2010. I think maybe just because we went out in heartbreak when wearing white shirts away from home. I think that's why it really reminded me of it. I did kind of forget Italy at the Euros. But I would still rank that performance in Slovakia is among the five best we've put in against a half-decent opponent in the last decade, you know. And the great frustration is, and Kenny has returned to this game since, you know, when things were going awry in November, and we'd ask him, like, what's next year going to be like? He would look back at that game and say, that was the game when everything mattered. That was a really important game, and it was one of our best performances in years, you know. And while that's true, with McGoldrick was so central to everything good that Ireland did, it's difficult to use that game as a template for anything going forward.
It's kind of weird, and I think maybe Richie Sadler set the tone straight after the game when he kind of said what you said there. But it seems like everyone in the fourth estate, you know, everyone in the press is and was, after the Slovakia game, like, so on side with Stephen Kenny. And it's kind of mirroring what's happening in society as well, that then people who are coming out against Stephen Kenny, maybe in underlying comments after one of your match reports, Gav, or something like that, are kind of being shouted down as not intellectual, not knowing what they're talking about, refusing to look at the stats, refusing to look what's in front of them. There does seem to be a bit of a chasm between what you're saying and what your colleagues in the press pack are saying, and then, you know, people, I suppose, I'm only talking to people online at this stage, but there does seem to be a lot of, after this game especially, a lot of below-the-line comments which aren't then being echoed by anyone in the actual press.
Yeah, that's interesting. A few things on that. Firstly, that people below the line of my article are abusing someone other than me, I will take as a bit of a victory. Now, look, I remember, to mention Richie Sadler, I remember I was listening to Second Captains, and he was on, and they're talking about a Nations League game, and he was getting all excited. He was like, why am I getting so fucking excited about a UEFA Nations League game against Finland? And I was thinking again, it was like, because he so desperately wanted Ireland to win, he hasn't been engaged with Ireland to this extent in years. And I was, you know, I've become quite engaged in the games as well, and I was thinking about that comment, and I was like, maybe it's because for many of us, and I actually probably would include myself in this, and it's something I have to kind of work with, is that all of our criticisms of Martin O'Neill and Mick McCarthy and so on for playing poor style of football and not believing the players, they're on the line now, because, you know, Kenny is the kind of avatar for that kind of criticism and a way of doing things differently. So I think there is a level of, we have skin in the game here, you know. So I think that's I think that a trip that I think you could apportion some of the criticism to that on the chasm. Like, one of the difficult things about this so far is that the only place to gauge reaction to Stephen Kenny's Ireland has been online, because there's been no one in the stadium, you know. So, and the natural, like, online reaction, like, that's that kind of chasm, that kind of polarized warring between two factions, that's the natural way, like, online discourse plays itself out. You know, you only see the guys that shout the loudest and are the most performative, because, and the most blunt and the least nuanced in their criticism. So I think that's one of the reasons why you see it that way. But in fairness, it's not just the form in which that kind of discourse is being delivered. Because Kenny has always been kind of, like, we go back to what I said earlier on, like, Kenny has always been kind of separate to FAI and the Republic of Ireland national team, because he comes from the League of Ireland, and the League of Ireland has traditionally been an almost entirely separate entity to the national team. It's one of the great failures of the FAI that we've never had, that the two have essentially been broken for so long. Like, this year, Jack Byrne played in a competitive Irish international, and he was the first domestic player to do so since 1985. Like, that was like, Pat Byrne played then. That was Owen Hand's last game. That was before Jack Charlton came in. So I think that's part of it as well, you know, and that there's always been that. I in the entire pie chart of Irish football, I don't know how much of it is taken up by guys who are, you know, just support your local team and fuck you for following a premiership, versus, you know, I mean, the people who look down on the League of Ireland as, you know, to use Eamon Dunphy's old line, like a chicken league, you know. I don't know how representative they are of the, like, of all the Irish football following, but it's a significant minority at the very least. And Stephen Kenny, like, that's a battle. Stephen Kenny is going to be a battleground between those two groups of fans.
Stephen Kenny seems to represent different things, or you can make him represent, make him a representative of what you want to believe in. So if you're a rabid League of Ireland fan, he's your guy. He's in there, and it's, you know, he's going to do it, and he's going to prove that the League of Ireland was great all along. If you're someone who maybe supports a premiership team, not from flying over, but from the television, and looks down at the League of Ireland, he's not the guy, because, you know, he doesn't have the experience, and you probably also believe that the Irish can't run themselves, even though you're Irish yourself. You know, you've probably inherited these nasty colonial stereotypes about us and about yourself, and now you're reflecting that in Stephen Kenny. If you're a nationalist, maybe you're more into Kenny because he's Irish and he's talking about breaking the link with British style football. If you're, see yourself as like a Jonathan Wilson type reading football fan, you're into Kenny because he's into passing, and people who talk about Kenny are into stats. So there's quite a lot of people claiming different ownership of Kenny. And again, this is because I've spent way too much time online this year. But I don't know, is there something in this?
Yeah, I know, I think so. What I would say is, like, anyone who has a firm opinion on Kenny either way, like, you know, the Kenny is like, this guy is absolutely the real deal. Like, I mean, this guy is going to be a massive success. I know this year has been hard, but he's going to be super successful. And if you think that this guy's not up to anything, you know, he's not qualified for the job, get rid. Neither of those opinions are valid, in my opinion, because based off what we've seen so far, you know, there's been injuries and COVID issues and empty grounds and so on mitigate against anyone making a ruling, the firm idea in their heads that this guy's a failure. It's not reality. At the same time, we've only scored one goal. We've really struggled in games at times. Like, that's proof. Like, you can't immediately say this guy's a success already, because he has things to prove, and like this, and he knows that. Like, this year hasn't gone as well as it could have gone. So I think, like, if you have, I basically that's a long way of saying what we've seen so far. You can't make any firm deductions yet, which is a little bit frustrating, because it doesn't give us a whole lot to build on going into next year.
Okay, Gav, we didn't really get into Slovakia against Ireland, but, you know, there's nothing really to get into apart from the fact that we lost and our best player from that match doesn't play for us anymore, David McGoldrick. But the other thing, and this was like, if Videogate hadn't happened, this would have been the big controversy of the year, was, I remember the teams came out that night and it was McLean is starting. And everyone, you know, shockwaves. Then it turns out he's starting because of one of the most convoluted and I'm still not sure what actually happened, but it was COVID. People sat in seats that they weren't meant to sit on. The Irish testing system was different to the European / British testing system, which ruled people out because they weren't so many separate meters apart. That launched us into the Wales game, which was, you know, mind-numbingly terrible, apart from James McLean's red card, nil all, on a sunny enough day, actually, if I remember correctly, in Lansdowne. But let's look at that little, those two matches as a block, and the COVID controversy around there, because that was when the questions of should we actually be playing football kind of really started.
Well, initially it was kind of like, who fucked up here? I definitely felt like that they were the first questions being asked after the playing stuff. I'll give you a brief synopsis of what happened, mainly because I spent a long time trying to figure this out, and I'll be damned if I'm not going to regurgitate it off on top of everyone I meet. So initially, like, obviously the players are in a COVID bubble, so everyone's tested together and they go in, and so in theory the place is biosecure, so there's less of a need for physical distancing and so on. But the day before the FAI got on their flight to Bratislava, one of the staff, a non-playing member of staff, tested positive for COVID. He was pulled, and a colleague from the same department was added to the flight because he could go in, because that colleague was meant to be working with the 21s. So he had been tested off the whatever Irish company the FAI used for their private testing. So got on the flight, not a bother, landed in Bratislava. But before he was allowed into the stadium, under UEFA rules, everyone has to be tested by the same lab. So it's called Synlab. So UEFA tested their official diagnostics partner, by the way, which is a sponsorship like Ed Woodward will be kicking himself that Man United haven't had. So this staff member was tested along, like Josh Cullen was added late to the squad, so he got tested as well. Anyway, the morning of the game, this guy's test comes back positive, which meant contact tracing kicked in. And so the FAI are working under HSE health rules. So they define, and it's weird, like the HSE define a close contact as differently to other health services across Europe. So I think in the UK, it's only if you spend more than 15 minutes within 1 meter of someone with COVID, you're a close contact. Here, it's 2 meters. So Aaron Connolly and Adam Ida sat behind this staffer on the plane, at the back of the plane, and as it turns out, they spent the flight 1.7 and 1.9 metres from the dude. So they were close contacts. And there's a question like, well, why the hell were players sitting with staff? That hasn't happened since Saipan. You know, one of the learnings taken from Saipan was like the players would be well separate to the Blazers and so on. They sat in the wrong seats, as did another two players on the opposite aisle, but you know they were far enough out of danger so they weren't really noticed, so they missed the game. And as it turns out, that guy was false positive COVID test, so they didn't need to miss the game at all. And then on the way back from Bratislava, one of the players tested positive, so that took him out and the four people sitting next to him on the plane. So Kenny lost five players from the squad against Wales the morning of the game, and four of them we're going to start. So we only named half a bench. It was an absolute mockery. And then there was like, well, I have to say, there was actually wasn't too much of a controversy about it. I thought it was a bit undignified and a bit unfair on Kenny's part. So Kenny was very annoyed and frustrated, as he would be. Now, you could blame the FAI for allowing the lads to sit at the back of the plane and not telling them to move. I would be kind of forgiving of that, to be honest. You know, it's not really a big deal, but I guess in COVID times, every tiny little error is exacerbated and multiplied. But Kenny was annoyed and said, you know, this guy was a non-essential member of staff. This guy who ultimately had a false positive. And, you know, he was pressed on it. And ultimately, Kenny said, look, he's not taking the free kicks. And the FAI, perhaps understandably, one of their employees, like, you know, everyone here is equal. That guy needed to be on the trip. He was a member of the communications department. We need someone on the ground. Just before the Wales game, Gary Owens, the interim CEO, who's still there, even though he's been outgoing for a few months, gave a clatter of interviews to say, like, the seating on the plane is a red herring. You know, if we were to put a 2 meter distance between everyone on a flight, we need four planes. And like I can't afford to send four planes to everywhere. So you had a little bit like Kenny and Gary Owens at odds. And I don't think it was great for Kenny that Owens got out in front of the story ahead of that game and started saying things that essentially contradicted the manager. So that I mean, that's, you know, Ireland played fairly well in very difficult circumstances in that game, but yet most of the questions Kenny was asked afterwards was about that.
Does it maybe tell us or lose something to Kenny still seeing himself as the outsider and not inside the FAI bubble, for use of a different word, in the fact that he was, you know, I remember how he was in those press conferences, and I took from him that the FAI had really messed up here again, from his language, his body language, and his language. So maybe does it tell us that he still sees himself as, you know, that guy like the rest of us who has a bit of a chip on our shoulder about the FAI and how
I don't think so, to be honest. I think he's just unbelievably frustrated and annoyed. You know, that this is his big, like, that game against Slovakia is one of the biggest games in Stephen Kenny's career, you know? And he had, like, imagine how long he had, like, he took the senior job in April. Like, he had been preparing for that match for 5 or 6 months. And then to lose two of his starters, Connolly and Ida, crucial to his attacking plan the morning of the game, is unbelievably frustrating. And you know, it's kind of natural that, like, you'd lash out. Yeah, I would lash out, you know, and you wouldn't go full on like King Lear on the cliffs, like screaming at the clouds, but like you would want to lash out with someone. So I can understand why he was annoyed. And look, if the FAI had patrolled things absolutely to the letter of the law, the lads would have sat in their seats and it wouldn't have happened. But it is such a minor thing, really exacerbated by extraordinary circumstances, that I wouldn't be throwing the FAI's logistics person under the bus at all. And actually, when Gary Owens and Stephen Kenny, like, as far as I'm aware, that's quite a strong relationship. And I think that the strength of that relationship was important a month later.
That triplet of games ended with a 1-0 loss away to Finland. What I remember was there was people at the game wearing masks. You could see, and it was kind of weird to hear a bit of actual noise rather than the piped in noise that we'd been hearing on TV since the summer. How were we all feeling at the end of that run of three games?
Oh, I remember the main feeling was like, thank God that's over. You know, it was such a horrible few days, like all COVID cases and players being lost ahead of the game. Like, we lost, like, Jack Byrne tested positive ahead of that game and was put out of the flight as well. And now you're beginning to wonder, geez, are we just unlucky with all these COVID cases, or is something going wrong? And Connolly and Ede actually came back for that game. I think that, yeah, the dominant thing was like, this isn't real football. You know, this is, you know, trying to dodge an invisible pandemic. And it's it's a bit too difficult even for something as logistically talented as the FAI have traditionally been. So I think that the main feeling, if I remember rightly, was just, thank God this is over. The Wales game, I thought it was 0-0. Wales were abominably bad. We did pretty well in the circumstances. And like, Shane Long missed a sitter. Like, he should. Like, the Howrahan miss in Slovakia is the big miss, obviously, of the Kenny reign so far. But that, you know, that long header in front of the, at the Aviva Stadium against Wales was another big miss as well. And given what the players were up against, like, I mean, we lost. Matt Doherty played 2/3 of the game at centre back, you know. That was quite an admirable performance, I felt, even though we didn't get the goal. We were much better than Wales on the day. And then went to Finland and again played fine. I mean, you know, if we want to go back to the skeptics and the disbelievers of Kenny, you know, the Finland game would give them a lot of ammunition, because we had the majority of the ball. We passed about, we didn't score, and we conceded because Darren Randolph played a bad pass out from a goal kick. That was a poor mistake. But we did enough, to, you know, kind of. Kenny looks back and says, we should have scored. You know, I know Ronan Curtis forced a really good save from the Finland goalkeeper from a back post header late on. I think we might have hit the bar in the game as well. There was Matt Doherty had a chance. Enda Stevens had a chance near the end. And I know maybe, you know, oh, these are kind of chances for fullbacks. They're not gilt-edged chances. Maybe are we clinging to straws here by talking about them as chances? But I remember coming away from that window being like, thank God that is over. The Slovakia game was really disappointing, and how, like, really kind of heartbreaking for the players. So disappointing to miss out on a penalty shootout. It's their first penalty shootout since the 2002 World Cup, like. And then those two games in the Nations League were so COVID affected. You're like, well, let's suspend judgment here, while acknowledging, like, again, another three games without a goal isn't great. But no one was really talking about the goalless run until we got to November.
In November, we played England. Why did we play England?
So I remember watching and doing my match report, and the only voice in my head was like Sepp Blatter saying, yeah, they asked for that, really. And we were, as it turns out, we were contractually obliged to play a friendly because all of the TV deals now in UEFA are centralised. So that includes Nations League, and then a couple of friendlies every year are also contractually obliged under the contract, obviously. And the initial plan was that the losers of the semi-finals would play each other in a friendly. So that meant we were meant to be playing Bosnia. But Bosnia, like, I mean, going all the way to Bosnia in a pandemic, not ideal. They took a friendly nearer home, and then that left us. New Zealand were meant to play at Wembley but pulled out. So it made sense for us to actually play at Wembley. If we had to take a friendly, it did kind of make sense to take that one, because it also meant all of our players at that stage were UK-based. Jack Byrne was to join up afterwards, so there would be less messing around with flights and so on, because flights were, you know, that's the big COVID issue. It wipes them out as close contacts. So that's why we played that game. It was a disaster, I think. You know, we played all right for 10 or 15 minutes, and then England just swatted us aside. But there's this
10 or 15 minutes thing, after the England game, I heard that so much in analysis. Well, in the first 10 minutes, I was like, stop talking about the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, no, there was two. I mean, people clung to those first 10 minutes too much. Like, I don't think we had a shot in those first 10 minutes, you know, either on or off target. We looked decent on the break. Again, Alan Brown, who I think has been one of the better players for Kenny so far, looked pretty good, and then was obviously knocked out of the next game because of COVID. But like, England just swatted us aside. Like, it is kind of scary now to see that the gap is huge. Like, that's the England B team. They are much, much better than us, you know? And like, I know, like, back in the day, we were quite, I know that's our first defeat to England since, what, 1985 or something, but we hadn't played them we went however long without playing them between the Lansdowne riots and the draws in 2015. There's a huge gap there at the moment, I have to say. And it was 3-0 to England. And England effectively declared it 3-0. Like, I mean, that third goal went in, I was thinking, this could be six. This could be really grim. Like Cyrus Christie at right back was really quite poor. He was bombed out after that. If Sean Gannon finds form at Shamrock Rovers, I think that Gannon might actually come into the mix ahead of Christie as kind of like your third choice right back after Coleman and Doherty. But that's tangential. Yeah, no, we were absolutely blitzed, and it was a game actually that would resurface again later on in the month. But it was a terrible night.
Have you spoken to anyone who watched the video?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
And what was their take on it?
Nothing in it. Storm and a teacup stuff. You know, look, standard kind of motivational video to make us proud that we're Irish and we play for Ireland. You can argue the merits. I saw a sports psychologist who I can't remember saying, my concern is not, you know, what he said or anything or how people... It's the fact that this is being used to motivate players in the modern age. I have some sympathy for that, but in the sense, like, you know, these guys pretty much all work in England. Like, a lot of them will be married or going out with English people. Some of them will have raised kids in England. Why do you need to get into this? But at the same time, I was thinking again about it, and I was like, you know, if we're going to hire Stephen Kenny as manager, we have to let him be himself, you know? Like, not... Oh God, I'm going to sound like the worst kind of centrist media figure now by quoting the West Wing, but like, you know, let Bartlett be Bartlett. Let Kenny... be Kenny. And this is what he does. You know, he's very historically aware because if you've ever read his programme notes at Dundalk or otherwise, you know, he's very engaged socially and historically and wants to fold football into that. Interesting, actually, by the way, the FA haven't had him writing programme notes yet, which I find kind of interesting. You know, there was the first match programme in the home game had in the contents page manager's notes and then nothing on the page, which is interesting, but I don't know how much we can read into that. But this is what he does.
There's been a program, obviously having been at Lansdowne, there's been a program for every... A program has been published for every Ireland game that's been at Lansdowne.
Yeah, and...
And Kenny hasn't had notes in it.
Another minor point, like the FAI programs are actually really good. I think Gareth Myer is kind of at the fore of them. They're excellent. Like, they really are, all through last year and stuff, they're always very, very good, but it's really disappointing because Mick had program notes last year, like, so very disappointing. I was really looking forward to reading some Kenny notes. But to get back to the point at hand, like, Kenny, like, talking about the historical stuff, like, that's what he does. You know, I was talking to someone who works with him at Dundalk and said, you know, they went to, was it Maccabi Haifa or Maccabi Tel Aviv that they played in Europe?
Tel Aviv.
And he talked, you know, he talked about Israel, the Israel-Palestine conflict in the dressing room, you know? I mean, that's what he does, you know? And, like, I have, maybe you can argue whether it's cringy or not, but the problem is that the public can start passing judgment and criticizing what he's saying in the dressing room. We shouldn't have access to what he says there. Like, that's the issue. But the motivational video is a 3-minute thing splicing together Irish goals against England from history along with scenes from Anglo-Irish history such as the Rising and so on. What people in the FAI coaching department would call a hype video, just, you know, and it would be pretty much maybe not routine, but would not be unusual to show to players ahead of games, you know, their personal highlights cut together with thumping music. Like, Pep Guardiola showed one to Barcelona players ahead of the 2009 Champions League final, like scenes from the Champions League run interspersed with Gladiator, with that Gladiator music. Now, all the players and Pep afterwards said, well, that was a bad idea because we played terribly in the opening few minutes of that final in Rome against Manchester United. But yeah, that's what he did. I think, but ultimately it was like a total storm in a teacup, and it was quite, I find it very regrettable that Kenny had to deal with some of the nonsense that he took from especially elements in the UK press.
Was the leaking of the video to the press part of a coup attempt against Kenny?
I don't know, but the worry is that Stephen Kenny perceives it as, if not directly in terms of a coup, but definitely in terms of an effort to undermine him. Because he effectively said so. He finally talked about the video last week at a couple of weeks ago after the draw at a press conference after the World Cup qualifier draw, and he said that the leak didn't come from the players, you know. So the dressing room, no problem there. But there may be people in the background or behind the scenes out to damage the team or don't have the team's best interest at heart. And then he didn't go any further. Now, I have to say, I don't think he should have left that hanging. I can understand if maybe he was told he had to leave it hanging, but I really think that, because he stopped it there, because then we followed up like, well, who are these people? That's the obvious question. And he effectively said, that's all I want to say. But that this is not a good working environment now, you know, that Stephen Kenny believes that people may be trying to damage him. We don't know whether they're within the FAI or outside, by the way, who's leaking this stuff. He didn't say behind the scenes, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean behind the scenes at Abbottstown, in fairness. But if Kenny believes that someone is working to damage him and his team, it needs to be dealt with. Because if the FAI are going to back Stephen Kenny, as they have up to now, then, like, This is not a good working environment. He cannot work. He cannot do his job if he fears that what he says in the dressing room will leak out and will become fodder for English tabloids and for the thing of the day to talk about and laugh about online. It can't work that way. So that, like, he obviously has an idea where it's coming from. If he's not told us, but he should have told the FAI. And if he has, and if it is within the FAI's power to deal with it, which, you know, it may not be, in fairness, because we don't precisely know where it came from, but if it is within the FAI's power to deal with it, they need to deal with it.
Damien Duff robustly defended the video on RT's Champions League coverage a few weeks back. He said it was, you know, goal, as you said, goals against England with scenes that we should be proud of then as Irishmen mixed in. And then another part of his backroom staff, Alan Kelly, had to tweet you know, his own disgust that he had been linked to the leak. So this is, with all FAI stories, you eventually become really jaded and bored of talking about them. But this one, I think, will seep into 2021, or might seep right through Stephen Kenny's reign until, you know, a new man is in and we discover exactly who was behind it and exactly what their motivations were.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, for as long as results are bad, this kind of stuff just talked about, you know, because what followed that initial story to the UK Daily Mail were a couple of stories in the Irish papers talking about how, you know, cracks appear and the senior players are, you know, uncertain about Stephen Kenny's eccentric methods and all this. And I would dispute the accuracy of it, you know. I mean, we saw, like, James McLean commented publicly, said, you know, against leakers and so on. I have no, maybe thing, you know, maybe things aren't ideal behind the scenes, but like nothing I have heard and people I have spoken to would suggest that there is any major issue behind the scenes at all. And I know that, you know, for, so the FAI said they were urgently looking into this in that statement to the UK Daily Mail when this first broke. I know Gary Owen spoke to about 12 people involved, you know, including senior players, and all of whom generally back Stephen Kenny. Like it was non, Stephen Kenny said it was a non-issue. And Kenny said the video was a non-story, and I agree that the video is a non-story, but it's not the content of the story that's the problem, it's the existence of the story.
Why was it the UK Daily Mail that got it?
Oh, I haven't a clue. I don't know. I mean, who knows? I mean, there's, I don't know how it got out. You know, it might just be like one player talked to his loose lips, talking to an agent, you know, agents will have connections, you know, UK agents will have connections in the press to, you know, to use them, for want of a better phrase, use them as best they can. So I have no idea how it got to the UK Daily Mail. I would say like the Daily Mail's claim that, you know, senior players were shocked at the political nature doesn't stand up to what I have reported and what other Irish reporters have reported since.
Senior players such as James McLean, who a couple of days after the video leak story came out, wrote his own article in the Derry Journal on why Ireland should be united. So that's the senior players who were shocked of the video's content. But yeah, I don't know. We could still be talking about this next year. The last two games of 2020, Ireland continued its tour around Brexit Britain. It went to Wales, lost 1-0. And then we finished up at home to Bulgaria. And I actually remember watching the Bulgaria match. Well, I should remember, it was less than a month ago. But I remember watching the Bulgaria match, and I was watching it on a streaming site, Score Live. It's like this Russian kind of illegal streaming site. And halfway during the game, or sometime in the second half, I actually found myself looking at the other feeds that were on that streaming site. And one was like a Minsk indoor football league. And they were really good games. Five aside, big hits going in, big challenges. Another video stream on that was like a 3-on-3 league in Russia with no stick goalkeeper. It seemed to be really fast games with interchangeable teams. I have no idea why they were on this site. But I remember Ireland were playing Bulgaria, and I was watching this, and I was like, okay, something has happened this year. Something has gone wrong this year.
I was at the game, so there was no Minsk five-a-side football, unfortunately, available to us. So the Wales away, I thought it was a very bad performance. That was a bit of a worry. What Jack Byrne came on was decent in the last few minutes. That was the game in which he became the first domestic player to play competitively since 85. Yeah, I don't think, I mean, two fairly average teams, and the game was ultimately decided by the best player on the pitch, Gareth Bale, and his spring-loaded calves jumping at the back post and heading across. Again, the Irish defence looked poor. One thing that I've been kind of disappointed with under Kenny so far has been the quality of our set pieces. So we scored, the only goal of the year so far came from Robbie Brady corner, Shane Duffy header. And Kenny made the point that we don't score enough from corners. You know, that was our first goal directly from a corner since Daryl Murphy scored against Moldova in 2017. But with, like, because Duffy is so good at set pieces, we only ever target him. So it's now become, like, if he gets a run on a defender, he's still almost unstoppable. But, you know, opposition are just flooding enough numbers around Duffy to kind of take him out of the action. And, like, we haven't showed enough craft around set pieces, or no one else has really stood up as an alternative head to Shane Duffy's head. And you know, Kenny said we don't really have a whole lot of time to work on them, so maybe that's a mitigating factor against it. I remember that being a kind of an issue against Wales. We love these set pieces and we just did nothing with them, and then conceded a bad goal. And I think Shane Duffy was, you know, Shane Duffy out of form at Celtic, and I think was just trying a little bit too hard with Ireland, like, you know, charging around trying to be the hero, especially in that Wales game. Like, he rushed over to kind of clear the header of the near post when there was no need to, and then that left the space for David Brooks to head home from a yard out. So Kenny hasn't been helped by, you know, the likes of Duffy being out of form and so on. So that was a bad, bad game against Wales. The first half at home to Bulgaria then was really bad. Like, that was fairly grim. Again, you know, missing half his initial squad, but I still think, like, the players that he had should have been capable of performing better against Bulgaria at home. And then second half, created a few more chances. Ronan Curtis missed an absolute sitter, like, on the penalty spot, all the time in the world to score. and should have scored, you know. And and I think that I actually think, like, at that point, the goalless run was pretty much all that we were talking about. Like, we were into kind of record territory now. Like, we're definitely record for Irish, from Irish football history, and we're closing in on Northern Ireland's international record. You know, it's that bad now. And I think that weighed on Ronan Curtis's mind when he just took so long. He had so much time to score. He was completely free on the penalty spot and just skewed it over, you know. So, and I think that, you know, and then, you know, that's all the press are asking the guys, the players about, you know, just his goal is run. So I think it weighed heavily on minds at that point. You know, if Curtis scores that, if Shane, you know, I mean, chances have been created. I think we're in the realm of being quite unfortunate not to have at least one more goal over these games. But yeah, those closing games were really quite poor, I thought. The Wales away was possibly the worst of them all. And things improved in the second half against Bulgaria, and we got the draw that meant we weren't relegated to Nations League C. So we'll be befouling Nations League B for a third straight campaign next year, or the year after next. But yeah, it was a pretty miserable end to 2020, those games, I have to say.
Yeah, like, we'll be bringing this pretty miserable chat to an end soon as well. I don't know, this time next year, if we're having the chat, like, let's not get into predicting games or predicting the qualification to come, but like, how do we see it going?
It's, you see, the great frustration is I don't know, because we've had 8 games now, but because there's been so much upheaval and chopping and changing, I don't know what his best team is. I don't know necessarily what his best formation is. It's probably some style of 4-2-3-1, but I don't know, like, that has changed from the 4-3-3 that he said he would play and plan to play in September. So it's really hard to know. Like, the group for the qualifiers is not terrible, you know. Like, I mean, it's Portugal will win the group. They're much better than the rest of the rest of the group and are much better than us. You know, we're in a race with Serbia for second place, you know. So, like, it's very hard to qualify for the World Cup, you know. There's only 13 teams from Europe are going to go there. So we need to get second place to get a playoff, and then we need to win a semi-final and a final. So we need to be 2 teams in the playoffs to get to a World Cup. So we're at, like, the opening game away to Serbia, like, you're thinking, like, maybe a draw there might be pretty good. And then there's a glut of games in September. I think there's 3 games in which we're playing Portugal and Serbia. And if we can just be ahead of Serbia at that point, then it's game on, because we have a relatively easy run in. We play Portugal in our penultimate game. I think that game might be in Dublin. But then Serbia have to go away to Portugal in their final game. So, you know, like, I mean, in spite of how bad things were in 2020, a draw in which no one's played a game always offers us some hope. But I'd be fairly pessimistic about our chances of making it to the World Cup. But even if we don't, I don't think that's necessarily a damning indictment to Stephen Kenny and the demand that he'll have to go. I think we'll have to see how the group plays out and how we do. But it's going to be a major, major challenge.
Yeah, you say it's not a damning indictment of Stephen Kenny. And, you know, the European qualifiers wasn't his gig. He came in because of the way the world went. But it's almost sometimes like he is getting a free pass at times. Like, even with your comment there, if we don't qualify for the World Cup, it's not a damning indictment of Stephen Kenny. When you don't know how the qualifiers are going to go and you don't know how damning those games are going to be.
Yeah,
but there does, yeah. That's maybe something that I'm trying to get to. There's kind of that kernel of feeling out there of, like, you know, he's not going to get as criticised or we're not going to let him be torn apart the way other managers who have approached the game in the right style have been torn apart when it doesn't go correctly.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's something I've been kind of conscious of, you know, because you can see kind of sides almost be taken in the press, you know, and I am conscious that I'm sympathetic to him. Like, I like him. I enjoy going to his press conferences. I find him to be a very honest guy, of a very interesting guy, and a guy who genuinely thinks that this is the best gig there is, you know. I mean, one of my frustrations with O'Neill was like, oh, can I get to Stoke City off this, you know. Eventually got to Nottingham Forest.
Stephen Kenny's not doing this job to put himself in the shop window for a championship mid-level, you know, table team.
No, he's not, absolutely not. So, and then you can see the other, some elements in the press being quite critical of him, you know, writing these stories about how there's cracks in the dressing room and so on. But my point, we have to criticise when they deserve criticism. I think that I've been critical at times of the, year that's been. I think it has been bad. I think that the circumstances can explain away why much of it has been bad, but it's still been worse than it should have been, if that makes sense. But like, I mean, not necessarily, like, I mean, it depends on how we don't qualify. This incredibly grim conversation at the end of the year, wondering about, how interesting would our non-qualification be? But like, say we like finish second place, get to a playoff, miss out, finish third place, couple of points behind Serbia. I don't necessarily think we should be firing the manager because of that, because then we just start again. And like, what's the point? The end can't always be qualification for a major tournament. Like that should be, that should be a byproduct of the means in which we're doing it. You know, the team should be good to watch. The team, like, people should want to spend their 50 quid to go to Lansdowne Road on We Can Do It Again to watch the team play. So I know what you're saying. Like, the guy gets a... I do think a lot of people are still on side of them. And I think there was a swell of support from the Irish football public in the wake of Videogate. But yeah, I can understand where you're coming from in thinking that he gets a free pass.
I don't know. When I shouted up this idea of doing this podcast with you, I was hoping you'd kind of say no. I didn't know if this would be good for our health, racking over Stephen Kenny's 8 games in charge of Ireland so far, and then looking towards the future. Like, you've given me nothing to hang my coat on in terms of next year and being better. And you know, you've just helped me bring back memories of watching those last 8 games, which have been pretty bad in terms of the results. Yes, we've passed it, there's been good stats, but yeah, it hasn't been pretty.
Yeah. And then one other thing I did want to say, and I forgot to mention earlier on, is like the circumstances of the year and the fact like we're now squeezing 3 international games into a window. Like, this, the conditions are not very conducive to like an overhaul of the system. That's beginning to become a concern of mine. Even if Kenny is the kind of, would be the right Ireland manager, are the circumstances right for him to be good, you know, to coach the side and get the side playing in the way that he wants them to play with such little time in the training ground? I think that's a bit of a concern for me now, I have to say. But, you know, I suppose we can live in hope for 2021.
Gav, thanks for taking the time to talk to us, and I look forward to reading your match reports on Kenny's games next year.
Oh, that makes one of you out there in the world. Brandon, thanks very much. Boogie, jab and rap is life where I'm from. Where I'm from, I might play with Izzy where I'm from. Where I'm from, it be like run your coat black. Jupiter keeps a fat beats by the pack where I'm from. Nappy hair is life, we be reading marks where I'm from. The kids be rocking clocks where I'm from. You turn around your cap, you talk over a beat, and dig some sounds booming out of Jeep where I'm from. Cocoon tied to you.